You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
Welcome to the second instalment of our collaboration with the Environmental Law Foundation, discussing reintroductions of species. In the first episode, we considered the right species, in other words, protected species, in the right place. Now we look at a more complicated question of the right species possibly being in the wrong place. The Foundation is acting for local residents in the Forest of Dean on a proposed translocation of species, which has prompted the organisation to think about the advantages, disadvantages, and many legal issues surrounding rewilding. That's why it's so important to bring scientific and legal experts together to consider what has worked in the past and what the challenges are for the future. I have with me James Wallace of the Beaver Trust, Kimberly Zier, environmental barrister at Landmark Chambers, and BAT expert Stephen Davison. Welcome all to LawPod UK. Stephen, bats. Before we get into the weeds of the controversy we're going to be talking about, can I just ask you, how do you monitor bat populations? Are you up all night?
Well, sometimes, yes. In the case of horseshoe bats, which are the ones we're talking about, they're quite evident in buildings. So one of the ways of monitoring them is just to look and count them in buildings. Otherwise, they're also very evident in hibernation sites, usually underground, and you can likewise count them there. Or alternatively, you can count them out when they fly out of their roosts on an evening.
As you are absolutely in there with bat numbers and the prospering or otherwise of bat populations, let's just get on to this whole translocation of pine martens. What kind of threat does this carnivore present to bat populations?
Well, it presents threats in two ways. First of all, it does eat bats, which is a particular risk with the horseshoe bats, because when they hibernate, it's like sleeping, although it can take half an hour to wake up. So when they hibernate low down on caves, for example, a pine martin, if it goes into the roost, can well eat the bats and they don't have time to wake up. So it could take a number in one sitting and then come back a few days later and do the same. Or alternatively, in summer, pine martins can be quite boisterous and they can upset the bat at maternity roosts, causing the bats to vacate.
I mean, we're talking about two species of mammal here. And let's be clear, they're both protected, but they have different levels of protection, don't they?
Well, up until recently, until it was released without compliance with the legislation, there were no pine martins in the Forest of Dean. Horseshoe bats are two different species, but two of the four species of bat that receive extra special protection, in theory, by our national organisations. They are rare and have been designated such that our national organisations have to designate areas where they receive special protection. The Forest of Dean and Wye Valley is one such area called a special area of conservation. Whilst all bats have some form of protection in their roosts and from disturbance, that doesn't mean that their feeding grounds, for example, are protected. But in a special area of conservation, our public bodies aren't allowed to do anything or to authorise anything unless they can be sure it won't affect the bats. So in this case, for example, it does or should give protection to the feeding grounds as well.
Let me bring Kim in here with a legal perspective. Kim, this SAC site, could you just describe how it came about to be protected in the way it is?
Yes, of course, Rosalind. So what we're looking at here is what's known as the EU Directive 9243 EEC, or more commonly known as the Conservation of Natural Habitats and Species, or the Habitats Directive. And what that directive did primarily was to establish a network of special areas of conservation across the European Union and European member states. And these were supposed to be, well, these are areas that are designated by member states, are areas in which special protections apply. And in this case, the special area of conservation that we are talking about was specifically designated as a result of the protected bat, horseshoe bat species that live there. And I can go on to now the protections and the obligations that apply in those special areas of conservation under the directive and domestic law.
It would be very helpful to understand how this protection works as opposed to the domestic protection under the Wildlife and Countryside Act at this point.
In terms of the directive, the main protection that we're looking at is under Article 6, and there are two sub-paragraphs within that article that are particularly important here. The first is Article 6.2, which is a general obligation within a special area of conservation on member states to avoid the deterioration of natural habitats and the habitats of species, as well as disturbance of the species for which the areas have been designated, so in this case, the horseshoe bats. But then there's a more specific obligation under Article 6.3, which is to carry out an appropriate assessment of any plan or project that is likely to have a significant effect on a special area of conservation. And once that process has been conducted, a national authority shall only agree to the plan or project after having ascertained that it will not adversely affect the integrity of the site. And then that obligation has been transposed into domestic law by what are known as the Habitats Regulations 2017, which effectively transpose the same obligations onto our national bodies.
Just before we go on with the legal detail, so what's actually happened here regarding the release of these animals?
So what's happened is these pine martens were captured in Scotland in a national park there, which I believe did require consent from Scottish Natural Heritage in order to capture these animals and to transport them into England. However, what's not required legally is any kind of permit or consent from Natural England, which is the English equivalent, to release those on private land or on any land in England, because these were previously resident in this country, and therefore there's no need for any consent there. And these pine martens were then released in the Forest of Dean, and there's potential, as Stephen has described, for harm to the protected bat species as a result. And in effect, Natural England has said that it doesn't have any role to play in this because it doesn't have to consent to these projects, so the obligations don't bite on it. And at the beginning, the Forestry Commission said something similar, but we've since had made some progress with them on that front.
And does it matter if the landowner, or indeed the releasing organisation, the organisation responsible for the capture, translocation and release, is not a public body, it's a private body? Are they caught by all these regulations?
Well, exactly. That is part of the problem here, which is that the organisations primarily involved are private bodies. And actually, if you look at the regulations, that they bite on public bodies of any description or any person exercising the function of a public body. That's in Regulation 7. But they don't bite on private bodies. And therefore, because Natural England and the Forestry Commission claim to have not given any formal consent to this project, they say that there isn't a public body that is bound by the obligations in this case. And we disagreed with that, both on the position of Natural England and from the Forestry Commission. The Forestry Commission ended up being a bit more straightforward because they ultimately admitted that some of these releases were taking place on land that was controlled by them. And we said that actually, if you look at the wording of the legislation, in particular Regulation 63, a public authority must not undertake or give any consent, permission or other authorisation for a plan or project which is likely to have a significant effect. And we said that if you're allowing a species to be released on your land, you are surely, by doing so, giving some form of authorisation, whether formal or implicit or otherwise, which means that this obligation is now binding on you to carry out a proper habitats regulation assessment, which was never carried out in this case.
Where have you got to now?
So we sent a letter before action, which is a formal protocol under the civil procedure before you initiate any kind of legal proceedings, to the Forestry Commission setting out this position, and they happily agreed that with that analysis, and they've now undertaken to carry out a formal habitats regulation assessment before allowing any other releases of pine martens, because we believe there are going to be further releases this year, and they've now undertaken not to do that until they've carried out a proper assessment, which is good news for the bats, we hope.
Indeed. It is a very confusing picture, isn't it? Because we're talking in this context about animals that are endangered and therefore protected under European law, and these are the bats, but also animals that have been driven to near extinction in this country, pine martens. And one of the effects of virtually wiping out a mammal or whatever wildlife you're talking about is to remove it from the protected status that it gets under the Wildlife and Countryside Act for animals that are normally resident somewhere. And this brings me on to beavers, because the reintroduction of the Eurasian beaver sets off a whole different set of legal triggers, because it's regarded as not native. This is where I turn to you, James. I know you have views on this native, not native dichotomy.
Yes, well, beavers are, Eurasian beavers we're talking about here, Castor fiber, were a species here resident until about 400 years ago. They co-evolved with the animals, plants, and other life forms over many millions of years. And humans sadly drove them to extinction because they taste good, they look good on our heads, they smell good, dare I say it. They even provide the basis for medicine because of the salicylic acid that they absorb whilst eating willow bark. So they're quite a valuable resource. And in fact, they helped us expand west over when we colonized America a few hundred years ago. So they were very, very important to our economy. And sadly, they vanished. So they were reintroduced, first of all, in about 2001-2 in Kent on a project with the Wildlife Trust there. And then later, that was in England. And then Scotland, they were reintroduced in 2009. And a series of trials have been undertaken. And in law, we've actually done a separate legal review with a firm. Not that we have any intention of doing a legal challenge, but we just thought we ought to really understand as a trust, with being the Beaver Trust. And what we've come to understand is that under EU law, if it's returned as a native species and it's once again in a self-sustaining population, which it is in England, they are protected in Scotland and have been since May last year, 2019. In England, they're still not protected and they're still not recognised as a native species. And we do wonder whether that might be in contravention to the EU law as it stands, albeit us leaving the EU shortly, and where we stand there. So it is actually rather complicated. As it currently stands, the beaver is on a schedule and doesn't have a European protected species status, but it does have recognition as a no longer normally native species, as you've just mentioned.
Which obviously cuts both ways, because if you're reintroducing or releasing beavers into a certain area, you have to get a license because they're not native. And that involves a whole range of obligations. But let me just ask you, why beavers? What are they for, apart from hats and medicine?
What are they for? Well, I can say the same about horseshoe bats and pine martens. They're all part of a complex ecological system that we are a part of too. And they, as a native species, are quite remarkable in that, unlike other species, I think pretty much anything, unless you go right back to Eurasian elephants and tarpons and some of the larger megafauna, they really do have a very considerable impact on not just other species for food. In this case, they're herbivores, so that's not an issue pine marten faces. But because they're an ecosystem engineer, they're a force of nature. They can be troublesome, and we'll come to that later on, because we live now in a very heavily managed landscape with managed rivers that have been straighted and canalised and dredged and all the rest of it. Some people even call them a climate ally, in that if you think of our situation in Britain and across the Northern Hemisphere where this species lives, there's a related species in Canada and North America as well, as you're probably aware. These animals can literally change the way whole river systems function by slowing down water. It's as simple as that. So by building a network of dams, they will slow water that there's there for use in drought by other animals, or in our case, humans, and also will slow water down so that it's much less likely to cause flood damage downstream. Now, pre-humans, that wasn't an issue, but now we live here in our buildings and farmer land and have our infrastructure. That's actually quite a big deal. So if there's a population of beavers living as they do in very high numbers of 1.5 million across Europe now, only about 1,000 in England and Wales and Scotland, then if you scale that up and apply those numbers to the upstream areas of river catchments, then it can make a very, very considerable difference to, in time, to floodwaters. Also, some other people refer to them as an extinction or biodiversity ally because of their nature, they slow water. That creates a safe space for animals to thrive. So, for example, algae will grow and zooplankton that will then feed the invertebrates, including insects, that then feed the fish and the amphibians and so on, up the food chain so that you then have large mammals benefiting and large birds too, and other species. So they provide the habitats and food for other wildlife. And then also they're regarded as a climate ally because of their ability to sequester carbon within their habitats. The mosaic of different sorts of habitats are quite extraordinary in the way they soak up carbon and obviously emit carbon simultaneously. But if you imagine a field that's ploughed up to the edges of a ditch that then becomes a wetland, it doesn't take much thinking to realise that's going to have a lot more carbon and other greenhouse gases absorbed. So there's quite a lot of benefits to them, but we can talk later about what the issues might be.
Well, let's go straight into that, because you say on your website, or your website says, that the process of bringing back beavers is not straightforward. I think that's a bit of an understatement, is it?
Yes, it is challenging for lots of different reasons. A lot of it is simply because they are no longer in our culture as a species. They're not normal, and therefore people have forgotten how to coexist with them. If you're a farmer or an angler or a forester going back hundreds of years, you would have been very used to beavers going around the place, and they would have just been a normal part of the wildlife, the fauna. This was the case and is the case across most of Europe now. We're lagging a little bit, as we Brits tend to, unfortunately, in nature conservation terms, but we are catching up. So the issues that we see that need to be resolved often come around the, not surprisingly, policy and legal situation. The fact that a number of landowners, farmers particularly, and fisheries managers might be affected in their income. And if you can imagine, a river now is very constrained, typically in a landscape where farming goes right up to the edge. If we were to create a buffer along that, then some of those obstacles, as you put it, would be removed because we wouldn't be competing over the same space with wildlife. Beavers would be included in that. So if we allowed our rivers to breathe more naturally across a floodplain, then I think that would probably resolve a lot of the issues. But also we've got to think about education and awareness, because beavers are a mystery to most people. If we look at what's been going on in Scotland, sadly, a lot of farmers have experienced issues where they don't feel supported or aware, there's no funding, and really there's a lot of work being undertaken to try and help them, by the way. But we've got an advantage here in England because beavers really haven't come back yet at all. There are a few, but they're very dispersed and not really affecting many people in a negative way. It means that we can be in advance, we can work ahead and try and increase education awareness, work with funders, and we would like to see work with governments so that there's incentives for creating space for these animals. For example, the new environmental land management schemes that are going to be replacing CAP and the basic payments, so that farmers are incentivised for economic services, ecosystem services rather, and therefore benefit from creating space for nature, not just beavers, but nature across their land.
Yes, we spoke about the environmental land management services proposed by the new agricultural bill in the last instalment of this discussion. And generally, people are excited and optimistic about it. And indeed, where I live in Norfolk, one of the estate managers here is following the example of Isabella Tree on the Knepp estate and has beavers. And I'm very excited to hear that in the beaver dammed areas, goshawk and otter are flourishing. So there's a certain kind of groundswell of certainly support from some farmers because of the publicity, possibly from Knepp estate.
Oh, yes. And in fact, there are a whole number of projects. In fact, Knepp are going to be releasing beavers under licence very shortly and adding to their menagerie of animals, including white storks. And as you've probably seen, the animals like peregrine falcons and turtle doves are returned from many years of absence. So very exciting work there. But there's a lot of other projects. My colleague Chris Jones runs the Cornwall Beaver Project. It started off in 2017 and has been shown through University of Exeter's research particularly to demonstrate very significant value to the flood defences. And in fact, his village, Laddock, downstream from him, has suffered over many years from flooding. And we hope as the population of beavers increase and if he's allowed to extend the enclosure they're in, then they could actually reduce the floodwaters in that village. So they're demonstrating actively to other landowners and farmers of the benefits. However, we mustn't forget that there are, and we as an organisation mustn't forget that there are very real and reasonable concerns that, for example, if there's a river system which is being canalised and has a levee system and beavers were to burrow through that and flood large areas of farmland, or dare I say it, a village, that could present a very serious issue. So as an organisation and as a movement, we are collaborating with government, so DEFRA, Natural England, the Environment Agency, and a whole bunch of different organisations from the big conservation NGOs like the National Trust, RSPB, and and Wildlife Trusts, Rivers Trust and so on, all the way through to fishing organisations like Wild Trout Trust, they're fish conservation organisations, a slight difference there, but they're very interested in angling, the Institute for Fisheries Management, and we hope to be able to engage with organisations like the Angling Trust and the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust, who are quite nervous at the moment about the impacts of beavers on fish, particularly migrating fish. So we see it's a really interesting and exciting time to bring all these vested interests together and try and align them. Beavers are back. What next? That's the question.
That's a very good note on which to finish thinking about beavers. But I just want to turn back to Kim here. Perhaps this is a bit unfair to ask you, but this terrible legal thicket that even legally educated people find very difficult to work their way through. Can you imagine a situation where these regulations, EU regulations, domestic regulations, could be improved so that we don't find that one environmental organisation is stepping on the toes of the other?
I think that's a really interesting question, and I think it's something that specifically in the environmental law field, there are question marks, especially in relation to EU environmental law and the jurisprudence that has become that's the case law back behind these directives and interpreting those directives has become stronger and stronger in terms of the protection that it affords to the environment, which I think most people would agree is a good thing, but it makes it quite difficult in terms of balancing these competing interests, which you might see in, for example, the pine martens versus bats situation. I think it's a case of ensuring that there aren't lacunae in the law and that the nature conservation bodies that are involved are able to talk with one another and to try and compromise, and that there's enough flexibility to enable them to come up with solutions.
I agree, absolutely. And in fact, I'd go as far as saying that the consultation we're doing with all the different organisations I mentioned earlier is showing that, in fact, whilst giving EPS status to the beaver, for example, might be a logical next step, we don't necessarily assume that that's necessary. We have submitted 9 proposals to DEFRA Natural England very recently with those organisations, not all of them that I named, but many others included, and that we've asked the question about safeguarding rather than protection. So trying to use a less emotive term in itself is quite a good idea, particularly if you're a farmer, forester or fisher that might have different views, or if you're worried that beavers might have a negative impact on other fish like migrating salmon and trout. And so it means that it takes a little bit of sting out of the tail there and opens the dialogue. And it also means that we feel as conservationists, that we shouldn't presume legal status. We should be working it out with the legal teams and between the conservationists and the different stakeholders, which means that in time, we may find with an animal like the beaver that it doesn't actually have total full level protection. And why would we do that? Well, if we have good management, then what the argument could be, why does it need to be a fully protected species? So if you were to go over the channel and you were to go to any of the countries that have large beaver populations, I'll use Norway as an example, they have the highest Atlantic salmon population and the highest beaver population. And the reason for that is that they have become normal again. The salmon and beavers have recovered together in numbers because they co-evolved, as I mentioned earlier, and they're allowed to be shot. Now, that may sound a bit shocking to some of your listeners, but they are now regarded a bit like we might do if you were in France shooting boar or deer. It is regarded as a normal member of the fauna. And I think that's a really healthy way of looking at things. I'm not saying we should advocate for getting the gun out now. We have a very much an endangered species, but a remarkable one. But at some point, we as a charity have no issue with that whatsoever at all. We shouldn't be too emotional about these things. We need to be practical. So the issue we think is about coexistence and management of these species. And then going back to your point about the competing charities, if you like, if you're looking at single species, we're called the Beaver Trust, but we're not a single species charity. We were going to be called the Natural Trust. We weren't for various reasons, but we're interested in wildlife and humans coexisting. So what we'd like to encourage the people who are making laws of the future is to consider, in licensing and for other reasons, that we look at ecosystems, not single species. Otherwise, we'll never agree on anything.
I think that's a very sensible way of thinking about things. And I think it's part of the reason why in our case, we took issue with the way that Natural England was approaching the problem of not our responsibility. You know, we don't have to license this, therefore we're not going to take any responsibility for it or see ourselves as being under any obligation to assess the potential harms and what potential mitigation measures could be put in place and whether those are backed up by the science in terms of protecting the bats. Because actually, they are responsible for the special areas of conservation. And if a national body such as that takes no responsibility as soon as a private body is doing the release, you're naturally going to get more potentially with some private bodies' specific interests being protected or promoted, rather than a bigger body such as Natural England that can see the whole picture on a more national scale and perhaps work with a group of different interested parties, do a better consultation and find a solution for both of these species that works and doesn't endanger one or the other.
It's fair to say that Natural England actually authorised this release. Without them saying everything was all right, Scottish Natural Heritage had said they wouldn't authorise the collection of the animals in the first place. So Natural England have actually authorised this without undertaking the necessary work. And in numerous bits of correspondence, they've shown conclusively how little they know about the horseshoe bats. They've claimed that greater horseshoe bats were in Ireland, which they're not. They've claimed that the Forest of Dean sack isn't at the edge of the distribution of these horseshoe bats, which, in fact, even their publicity on the special area of conservation says it is. So they just seem to show that they don't care. And that, I find, unbelievable, really.
That's a really interesting observation, Stephen. We're working quite closely with Natural England at the moment. As you can probably imagine, the beaver is a very hot topic. That's why, probably why I've been invited on today. It's all over the news, quite literally. And we already, if you look at beavers under licensed releases for enclosures, which is the only way of doing them currently in England, it's a very clearly defined and quite strict process that needs to be followed, and one that we support. I'm not suggesting it can't be improved. It's rather onerous, and I have to say it's rather expensive for the landowner. To buy beavers is very expensive, but to actually put up fencing and go through all the assessments is quite onerous. But we respect that that's necessary, and for the reasons you're giving, if we're looking at the impact of a species, whatever it is, but particularly a beaver, one that can actually change the way a river functions and a whole floodplain, then we must look at the impacts that will have on other species and also on the conservation status of those areas and, of course, humans and their livelihoods. And I think regarding Natural England, I would agree that there may be a lack in expertise, and our approach to that, and that's not in everybody, by the way, but in some areas, there are some very, very knowledgeable people and very keen members of Natural England who work with organisations like yours and mine. But we would like to encourage further education. So what can charities like ours or professions like ours do to work with government, whether it's Natural England Environment Agency or DEFRA, or Forestry England for that matter? How can we share the knowledge and that we can then get people up to speed so we can make good decisions collegiately?
I wonder whether there's some future hope, going back to the agriculture bill that goes through in its current form, that it'll be via the environmental land management schemes that quite a lot of this education can be funneled.
Yeah, from a riparian habitat and abutting fisheries and farming perspective, absolutely. The environmental land management scheme could be transformative, quite literally, to the way we steward our land and we grow our food and we restore nature. It is such a big deal. But I would also add to that, there are other initiatives that would be worth considering. The English tree strategy that Lord Goldsmith and Rebecca Power are working on at the moment, they're looking at how we can plant trees and allow trees to, I won't use the word rewild, we tend to avoid that, but to grow back naturally. That too has an implication in what we're describing here, as does the flood budget and the nature of a climate fund. So I don't think there's any lack of funding, or indeed, from what I've seen, any lack of interest within government. There's obviously a lot of pressure on government right now to make good decisions. But I think you're right, the mechanisms like the Environmental Land Management Scheme can not only incentivize and reward good stewardship, and rightly so, because we're talking about changing the way people generate their income, but they can be used as an education tool to shift mindsets and bring people together. Particularly, we would like to see across borders. We have a campaign we're launching at the moment called Beavers Without Borders, and we're launching a film shortly, and that's to try and encourage landowners and conservationists and all this just work together. You know, at the moment, if you manage a farm, you're doing it entirely on itself. You will probably talk to your neighbours, but you won't necessarily work together collectively. There are examples across Britain. Where I live in the Marlborough Downs, there's a very good example of farmers working together. I think there's about a dozen that are doing great work together, reinstating ponds and creating much wider hedgerows and things like that. That's the way we need to think about these things, doing it together.
So we've covered the current problems, the current lack of communication. Let's hope that, as you say, James, that bodies and individuals and farmers and conservationists will continue talking together, and there will be not only beavers without borders, but man and nature without borders. Thank you so much, all of you, for this very, very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.